Derek G's getting closer as the games continue. By the way, it's 8:22 to the front of the race, who we are informed is still Harper and Verre right now. But this is where the battle is being played up, on these lower slopes of a mountain that has so much history at this race in just the 20 years we've seen it. Yates with the biggest slice of that history. He goes, no reaction. No reaction this time, as Simon Yates is on his way up the Colle delle Finestre.
Hello and welcome to the Cycling Podcast. My name is Lionel Burney and the Giro d'Italia is already in the rearview mirror and it will soon be time to begin our build up to the Tour de France, which starts in Lille in little over a month's time. But first we're going to reflect on a sensational Giro and Saturday's extraordinary 20th stage, when Simon Yates exorcised the demons of the Finestre, erasing the memory of that spectacular collapse on the same mountain in 2018. That was when Chris Froome attacked 80 kilometres from the finish to take the pink jersey that Yates had worn for almost a fortnight. On Saturday, with a crucial bit of help from his Visma Lisa bike teammate Wout van Aert, Yates turned the tables in not dissimilar fashion on the young Mexican Isaac Del Toro, who had held the pink jersey since the gravel stage in Tuscany at the end of the first week. This episode will feature my conversation with Matt White, who is a familiar voice to all of our listeners because he's featured in the podcast's Grand Tour coverage since the very beginning, really, offering his tactical insight. For more than a decade, he has been at the Green Edge organisation and until a few days before the Giro was Director of Performance at the Jayco Alula team, when, much to everyone's surprise, including Matt's, it has to be said, he was let go with immediate effect and he left the team that he's worked for, I think, 14 years. Matt is one of the people who knows Simon Yates the best because Yates, until this season, rode his whole career for the Green Edge organisation and Matt was in the team car that fateful day on the Finestre in 2018. So he has a lot of insight into just what was going on the mountain on Saturday. We'll hear from Matt in just a moment, but before that, I'm sure everyone wants to join me in saying a big thank you to Daniel Freiber, Brian Nygaard and Michele Pellacci for their coverage of the Giro over the past 3 weeks. Daniel is taking a well-earned holiday before he transforms superhero style into television's Daniel Freiber in a week or so's time because, as he has done for the past 9 years, he'll be working for ITV at the Critérium du Dauphiné and the Tour de France. But he'll be back on the Cycling Podcast in time for the Vuelta a España later this summer. Anyway, earlier on today, I caught up with Matt White to get his thoughts on the 2025 Giro d'Italia. But I had to start by asking him what had gone on at Jayco Alula.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, Cycling Podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
That's Seb Piquet, the voice of Radio Tour, to remind me to tell you that this episode is sponsored by NordVPN, the virtual private network that will keep all of your data safe and secure when you're online, which, let's face it, is pretty much all of the time across multiple devices. NordVPN can help you protect all of your important private data, such as bank details and passwords, and also your online identity. It will protect you from viruses, malicious malware, and phishing websites which seek to hijack your data and then use it for nefarious means. NordVPN really is like a safety net for browsing the internet. It can be used across 10 different devices, so one account can cover your phone, laptop, desktop computer, even your Wi-Fi router or smart TV if you have one. All of our listeners can get a great deal on a NordVPN subscription. I've just renewed for another 2 years, but if you go to nordvpn.com/tcp, you'll get an extra 4 months for free on top of a 2-year plan. There's no risk either because Nord give a 30-day money-back guarantee. So go to nordvpn.com/tcp today. Well, thanks for joining me, Matt. I hope you enjoyed the Giro d'Italia. We'll get into all of that pretty deeply because, well, you're one of the people who knows Simon Yates best, having worked with him for so long. It was quite a dramatic conclusion to the Giro over the weekend. But before that, I've got to go back to the start of May and ask you what happened with Jayco Alula, because I was packing my case for Albania, getting ready for the Grande Partenza, and the news reached me. I think I saw it on Cycling News, first of all, from our colleague Stephen Farrand, that you were leaving the team. And people leaving teams mid-season is quite unusual. So I asked you whether this was something that you expected, and you gave me the impression that it had come out of the blue for you too. So what can you say? Have you signed a non-disclosure agreement or anything like that? Or are you free to talk a bit about what actually happened?
Yeah, no, it's been 14 years with the same organization, an organization that I put my heart and my soul into over the last long period of my life, and it's no longer. So I won't dive into too much more there, but I wish everyone the best there. But yeah, it has been a big big part of my life, and I'm looking for new projects now for looking for the future and moving forward. So yeah, it's a shame that it ended like this, but it's a professional sport, and sometimes it is what it is, you know.
Can you tell us who delivered the news to you, how you were told? Was it Jerry Ryan, the team owner, or Brent Copeland, the general manager?
Look, mate, I'd prefer not to talk too much more about it, you know. It's been a month now. I've moved on, and I'm looking forward to starting a new journey, a new chapter with whether it's in cycling, whether it's in the World Tour with women's cycling. I'm really not fixated on any particular role at the moment. I just want to go to an organization where I can make a difference and have an impact, which I have over the last 14 years with Green Edge.
Just one more. I won't interrogate you too much further about this, but was a reason given? Was it results-based? Was it because of a disappointing spring on either the men's side, the women's side? Were you given some kind of indication why they wanted to make a change?
Yeah, like I said, I'm not really here to talk about the past, and I am looking forward, not backwards, mate.
Well, you're a cricket fan as well. That's about the straightest bat that I've ever had to bowl at, I think, for a little while anyway. Maybe we'll talk a bit about Jayco Alula's Giro as well. But Simon Yates, I mean, he is a rider that you work with for a long time. Were you watching on Saturday, and what were your thoughts as the stage unfolded?
Yeah, no, I certainly was watching. It was an incredible stage, actually. And look, a week before the finish, I had a real gut feeling that Simon could get it done. And I think the reason why is because everything had fallen in place for him up until then. I don't think anyone really would have predicted what happened on Saturday and to the extent that the race was turned upside down. But, you know, I know Simon well, and I know he loves being behind the scene and just being quiet and doing his thing. And, you know, the team was off there winning stages with Walt and with Olaf, and he hadn't taken the jersey, he hadn't put his face in the wind too much, and he was in a very good place to pounce going into what we always know is a brutal last week of the Giro. And look, you know, everyone draws conclusions and makes comparisons to the 2018 Giro, which, you know, which Simon really did dominate for all bar 3 days of the race, winning multiple stages and having it in jersey. But I think a lot of people also forget that, you know, at the time it was obviously devastating, but, you know, Simon turned that round 3 months later and won the Welter. And I think a lot of people forget that yeah, that was a really harsh moment for his career, but real champions, and especially, you know, just get on with it. And he did in a very, very short time. Look, it's been a long time between drinks, between the Welter. And I was just thinking before, that's the first stage race that Simon's won since the Welter in 2018. But he's a world-class biker. Yeah, he's finished on the podium in the Giro in the last 5 years. He's finished fourth in the Tour de France 2 years ago. And the first COVID Giro, which Theo Guggenhardt actually won, Simon was in the form of his life there. And, you know, he'd won Tirreno 2 weeks prior. And, you know, I'm sure if he hadn't have, we ended up getting sent home because we had too many people with COVID. But Simon was definitely ready to win that Giro back then as well. So, you know, it's been a long time in preparation. I think he really cashed in on the years of experience and close calls that he's had in the last 7 years to give himself the best opportunity to get the job done on Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, you were there obviously in 2018 in the car when, I mean, it was a spectacular collapse on the Finestre, wasn't it? But this year's Giro, it was almost like he rode the complete mirror image of that year. Like you say, in 2018, he was chasing stage wins. He was trying to eke out seconds here and there. He was winning the race by just doing as much as he possibly could almost 3 weeks, 2.5 weeks. And then, of course, was hit by that huge break. Can you think back to 2018 and the feeling of when Froome first went and the sense of when the panic kind of set in and when it went from being an interesting move from a rider well-placed on GC to suddenly all the red lights are flashing on the dashboard and panic setting in?
Yeah, so I think from our side of things, the warning lights sort of came on 2 days prior, and I can't remember where the hilltop finish was, but it was the first time that Simon had actually lost time to the favourites, and it wasn't much. I think it was 20 or 30 seconds, but you know, he had a ding dong battle with Chris on what's that the famous climb in the Veneto region? Brutal one where he rode basically 10 seconds behind Chris for the half the climb, and he finished second on the stage. I can't remember off the top of my head what climb it was. It'll come to me later. And that was all. And then he had a very good TT. I think we were really worried about the TT at that stage of what how much time Simon would lose in the TT to the likes of Dumoulin and Froome, and there was some real time trial specialists there. And he got through that well. I remember doing the recon on the day before and going into it. Yeah, Simon's so unpresuming. And we went into a bar after the TT just to get a coffee before we went back to the hotel. And yet Simon was in the bloody Malia Rosa. And these people just looked at us sideways, and here's me and Simon and a mechanic walked into the bar and sat down and ordered 3 cappuccinos. We sat down in the back corner of the bar, and after about 10 minutes, people started coming over. And it was a couple of people, but really, really nice, and asking for his autograph and stuff. But that's Simon. You know, it was the same guy, just in the Malia Rosa getting a cappuccino before we head back for lunch on the recon of the TT. But I remember when we lost that first little bit of time, it was like maybe 2 or 3K to go. There was a couple of attacks, and he just got distance, and we're like, ooh, you know, that's if that's a bad day, well, we'll take it. You know, he still had a big lead. And then I think also reflecting now back to that attack from Chris Froome was probably the first long range attack from a GC rider. And now we see it week to week. We see it doesn't matter what race you go to, there's guys attacking at 50, 60K from the finish. And that was the first time that anyone had even attempted that sort of madness. And Sky had a plan there where it was all or nothing. You know, Chris had, I think it was his first race, was the Giro, I think, that year, and had really ridden into the race and came from a long way back. But as we know in the Giro, if you've got legs in the last week, that's where you can make the real difference. And when he went, I remember it was a very aggressive first hour or two racing before we got to the Finestre. And then we got there, and you know, when we'd heard that Chris had attacked, it was like, well, that's fine. Yeah, that's a long way to go. And then when the gap started to go out, obviously, you know, Simon was on the slide there, and it was a pretty long climb in the car, and a pretty long hour or two for Simon and the group of guys that he rode to the finish with. But I do remember thinking in that stage already, is how can we win tomorrow? And we ended up winning the next day with Mikhail Nieve on his birthday. So I don't know. It's a talent that you've got to have in this game, that, you know, you've got to move on quickly. And as devastating as it was for Simon, our focus turned. I remember talking to Mikel in the car, like we were driving up the climb, and I called him back. He was riding with Simon, and they rode at a snail's pace back to the finish line. You know, we'd obviously lost the Giro, but I called Mikel back to the car and I said to him, mate, you start thinking about how you're going to win tomorrow's stage, and he looked at me like, what the. Yeah, we've just lost the Giro, and he's. I'm asking him how he should win tomorrow's stage, you know, and he did. He went on a mission the next day, and he was a very loyal domestique throughout his whole career, and for Simon, we ended up finishing that Giro with 5 stage wins in the jersey for 2 weeks, so it was a success, but already when we debriefed and we a little bit of dust settled, the mission was to go and win the Welter and show the world that Simon Yates is a Grand Tour winner.
Couple of things there, Matt. Maybe the Italians were looking at you funny because you were drinking cappuccino after the permitted hours of cappuccino drinking. I don't know.
It was after 12. That could have been it. It could have been it. It was after 12.
I remember that stage you were talking about where he lost just 30, 35 seconds, something like that. It was Prato Nervoso, wasn't it? And it was just one of those little cracks that you see. We'll talk about this year's Giro in a bit, but you see it and you think, oh, that's nothing, or is it something? But the riders are getting so tired by that stage. It's not just the physical, it's the mental fatigue of losing a bit of ground and wondering. Because when they're off the bike, I guess they don't know either how they're going to respond the following day.
No, and I think the thing that did put a bit of stress on Simon, which he'd never really had to experience, is just that juggernaut of being in the jersey every day. And I can't remember how many days we'd had the jersey, but there was a couple of times there where we'd had to leave the bus waited for 40 minutes for him, and all there were stages where the bus had to leave because we had six riders who had to get back to the hotel on a three-hour transfer, and just the press conferences, the anti-doping, the arrival at the hotels later, all those little things. And Simon does not like that. And Simon wants to be a winner and leave his impact on the sport, but he doesn't. He's not a big fan of media. He's not a big fan of blowing his own trumpet. And that was his worst nightmare. And I think that's why this year's Giro worked so well, because he didn't take the jersey until the last day. It certainly helped. And look, he's 7 years older and a lot more experienced and won the Welter that year. So he's used to it now. But it's certainly something that we learnt from him back then, that we could service him better and do things easier for him because some people thrive on that. Some people, a perfect example was Ryder Hesjedal. Ryder Hesjedal, I've never seen a guy who it was a tour in 2010, I reckon, 2010, where he came into the tour, to 10 or 11, he came into the Tour de France as a worker for Christian Vandeveld, and then all of a sudden found himself in second place in the Tour de France after the Roubaix stage. And most people who come in as a domestique and then find themselves in the spotlight at the Tour de France would really crack under pressure and Matt Ryder, he just thrived on it. Ryder's mentality was like, I've always been this good. It's the first time you're recognizing it. And now the media attention around Ryder would crack most domestiques, and he just thrived on it. And he soaped it up and just got better and better. And so that's the difference in personalities, you know? Some personalities can deal with the pressure of the media and all that exit, and some people don't like it. And Simon's someone who has got used to dealing with it, but it's certainly not his preferred way of communication.
Do you think then that being in the Visma Elisabike team, where he was able to go so much under the radar for so long in the race, because when he was with Green Edge, he was the leader for the Giro or the Vuelta or whatever. It was a completely different role. It was almost like no one was really expecting Simon Yates to be a factor in this Giro d'Italia. He was kind of there as a sort of luxury mountain guy who might go for some stages or what have you. But all of the spotlight was on Wout van Aert after his spring campaign, and everyone thinking, you know, is Wout van Aert going to win races again? And of course, on the sprint days, they had Olaf Coy. So the attention and the focus was completely away from Simon Yates. But when we look back at how the race unfolded, he was just quietly there every day that he needed to be. He rode extremely well on the Strada Bianca stage, which again, for much more of a stage race type rider, that could have been a really tricky one for him.
Yeah, definitely, for a guy under 60 kilos. And I think as well is, the first part of the race, it was, the big story was around Roglic and Ayuso. And then there was the inter-team battle between who is leading UAE, between Ayuso and Del Toro. And Simon just sat there in the wings, did his thing, gradually slid up the rankings until D-Day. And even the Friday stage, which I watched, Simon looked very comfortable, and I saw some interviews that Simon did before the stage saying, look, I feel good. And I know Simon does not say that he feels good unless he And I'm even surprised that he even said it, because that's just not his. When I heard some comments he made, and then when I saw he was a little bit pissed off after the stage where how things didn't go however they had envisaged, Simon, a little bit angry Simon, who's confident of where he's at, that was the perfect concoction for what eventuated on the Finisterre.
Chute à l'arrière du peloton, cycling podcast team car at the back of the pack, please.
This episode is also brought to you by Saily. Now, if you're travelling abroad this summer, maybe on holiday, or perhaps you're visiting one of the Grand Tours, you're going to take your mobile phone with you and you want to stay connected as if you were at home. But unfortunately, a lot of mobile phone contracts build in quite expensive roaming charges, and they can really add up over the course of a holiday. What you need is Saily, which is an eSIM to keep you connected as if you were at home, but it will help you to reduce the overall cost by reducing or even eliminating roaming charges completely. You don't have to buy anything physical. You don't have to go to the airport and buy a local SIM to then swap over into your phone. You simply download the Saily app, which you can find in all of the app stores, or go to saily.com/cycling. Now, how does it work? Well, very simply, you download the app and then sign up to one of the plans. There are multiple plans covering over 190 countries and 8 regions, and they will give you the best rates possible. So once you've purchased your eSIM, go to the Saily app, download that, and really it's as simple as 1, 2, 3. You install the eSIM, buy the plan that you want covering the countries that you're going to be visiting. So if you are visiting maybe 2 or 3 different countries, you don't have to keep swapping or buying physical SIM cards to keep yourself connected. And let's face it, when you're on holiday, you do want to be contactable. Perhaps you want to be able to ring home. You want to be able to use your phone as you would, perhaps posting wonderful pictures on Instagram, stuff like that. So Saily is the way to go, and the best way to sign up and support the Cycling Podcast and get an exclusive 15% discount off your first purchase is to download the Saily app in your app store and use the code cycling at checkout, or go to saily.com/cycling. That's saily.com/cycling. Now back to my conversation with Matt White. What about a UAE Team Emirates then, and Isaac Del Toro? I mean, you follow young riders a lot. He would have been someone that you would know because, I mean, he won the Tour de l'Avenir a couple of years ago. Clearly a very talented rider. We saw him win Milano Torino earlier on in the season, but I don't think anyone was expecting him to be in this position where he was challenging Juan Ayuso for the leadership of the UAE Team Emirates lineup, right?
No. Look, like I said, Del Toro came out to Australia last year in his first ever World Tour race. He won a stage in Down Under, which is impressive. And then last year, I do follow his race program. He really hit the ground running as a pro last year, January, February, March. And then in the second half of the season, you know, he rode the Vuelta last year pretty quietly, which is normal for a 20-year-old. And actually, I'm sort of in one way glad that a 21-year-old didn't win the Giro, because it's not normal. It's not normal. You know, and he is a very, very talented young athlete. But, you know, the winning Grand Tours, and I think it sets a, well, what it's not I don't like, but, you know, there's a lot of young athletes there that work just as hard as him at 20, 21 years of age and aren't even professional. And this young athlete's nearly winning his second Grand Tour at 21. And so look, he's an incredible athlete. He certainly stamped his name on the map there as a future Grand Tour winner. And I think probably the biggest issue he's probably going to have at that team is his own teammates, or the schedule that he gets to get opportunities, because, you know, they realistically came into the race with 3 leaders. You know, there's Adam Yates. I'm sure if Adam Yates was in full flight, he's done as much, if not more, than Ayuso in his career, and he's a lot more experienced. But and I don't know how they approached it internally. I don't know, you know, what freedom guys were getting, or whether they were just going to say, well, let's see how it sorts itself out. But you could see a couple of times there, and I think Del Toro really grew personally when it was clear that Ayuso was injured. That Ayuso wasn't the leader. You know, I think he's, sounds like he's a young, respectful guy who didn't want to really want to go against team plans or against a guy who's marginally older than him. But he's a guy who I saw interviews with him as well, and he's a guy who didn't shy away from his ambitions, didn't shy away from, yes, he was happy with where he was in the leading the race with 3 or 4 days to go, but didn't lack any confidence going into what was a brutal 2-day block on Friday and Saturday.
Yeah, I mean, it was the gravel stage where he really got on the radar because he had that battle with Wout van Aert. And I think this is where we saw, oh, this lad, he's a kind of 1-day rider in a Grand Tour situation, because you can't really compare a Tour de l'Avenir to a Grand Tour, although it is a very good indicator of who is going to make a mark in stage races. I think the thing that really struck me, I don't know what you thought, was he rode a kind of Simon Yates 2018 style race. You know, he got 52 seconds in time bonuses over the course of 2.5 weeks. You know, he was chipping away. So although he was being respectful to Ayuso to a degree, he was also kind of feathering his own nest, wasn't he? He was building a Grand Tour campaign and growing into that pink jersey for sure. The question was always going to be, how is he going to stand up to the final week? And of course, on stage 16, which at that point was the hardest of the race, we saw him kind of falter a bit, but it was under pressure from Richard Carapaz rather than Simon Yates. Simon Yates was still keeping very calm and very quiet. What did you think about those 2 days in particular, Tuesday and Wednesday? Because he faltered. He just about held on to the pink jersey, which I think is significant, because if he'd lost the pink jersey that day, he could have been one of those young riders that then blew up completely and tumbled down the standings. But it gave him something to fight for. And then, heck, did he fight for it, because he bounced back and won the stage and gained a bit more time the next day. At that point, did you think this is going to be a tough cookie to crack, or a tough nut to crack, I should say?
Yeah, definitely, definitely. I think that the interesting, I think he bounced out of both rest days not that well. Now, it's probably something for him to learn, and I don't know what training he did on the rest day. I don't know what he ate. I don't know those details, but it's a pattern. Usually we see from older riders or bigger riders that, you know, some people have to train hard on the rest day, and it depends on what the stage is the day after the rest day or how you react. But there is a little bit of a trend there that he didn't bounce out of the rest day real well. Look, I know, for example, with the Yates brothers, those guys, and I don't know what Simon did this year, but I've been at Grand Tours with Simon where he does not touch his bike on a rest day, does not leave his room except for meals and a massage on a rest day, where I know guys that do 3 hours. So it is really, it's a real individual thing that works for you. And he, you know, because it is his second Grand Tour, I dare say he's still working that out. But I think what we saw there is when he did crack that first stage after the rest day, I thought, oh, I was the same opinion as you. I thought, oh, this is a normal young fella who's on the slide here. And then the day he bounced back the day after, I went, wow. Now, this is going to be interesting, because that's not a general trend, bouncing back like that in the third week. You know, usually it's one way or the other. You're either sliding up or sliding down. But he certainly showed that he wasn't finished, and even when I saw him on the Friday stage, I was like, oh, he is going to be very, very hard to crack here, very, very hard to crack on the Saturday, because he didn't show any weaknesses at all on the Friday, and he still was riding his aggressive style of racing, and you could see he was full of confidence. So no, I thought it was going to be really hard for him to come undone on the penultimate stage.
The other thing on Friday was UAE Team Emirates were mob-handed, weren't they? They had everyone around him. They looked like they were going to see it over the line for him. But then it was a completely different picture on Saturday. I mean, you know the Finestre very well because, well, you probably spent an hour and 40 minutes on it in 2018, I guess. It's a long climb, even for the fastest guys. I think Chris Froome's record on the climb was just over an hour. Simon Yates knocked 4 or 5 minutes off that, I think, but it's still an hour long climb. It is a brutal one, isn't it? And I suppose if you're not feeling good, you know, the door can swing off its hinges, can't it? But how did you feel tactically it played out, sort of going into the bottom of it? You know, Del Toro was all fine until all of a sudden it really wasn't fine.
Yeah, look, I think the two things that had big factors on that stage. So I think tactically, some of the teams made the mistake of not having the right satellite rider up the road. And probably the worst guy you can have up the road for Simon Yates was Wout van Aert. You know, you're talking about one of the world's best bike riders being up the road for his leader. That's whether how they could control that, I don't know. You know, I'm not in the team car, I'm not in the race, but that's a big group of riders that went set sail again for the second or the third or the fourth day in a row. So I think UAE, if they had had a McNulty up the road, a bigger, stronger guy, at least marking out Wout van Aert, or, you know, because or having someone up the road before the top of the finisher, that would have changed and that could have changed things. So that's the first thing that changed the dynamic in that whole attack.
Just on that, I mean, Wout van Aert got in that break. What would everyone else have been thinking he's doing? Because he's the Finestre, yeah, sure, he could get over it maybe with the breakaway. The finish at Sestriere isn't mega, mega hard. You know, it might just be. But surely they knew he wasn't aiming for a stage win. Surely they knew he was going up the road for a bigger purpose.
Yeah, definitely. But I think when he comes to stage 19 of the Giro, 20 of the Giro, you know, there's a lot of people dead in the water. And half of those people probably didn't want to be in the break themselves. But they're under team orders. We need to be represented. You know, there's half the teams in there hadn't won a stage. So obviously there's a lot of pressure from the teams. We need television time. We need to try to win a stage. I know with the Jayco guys, you know, The probably the best guy that they could have had up there was the guy who won the stage, Chris Harper, who had tried and failed the day before. UAE needed someone there up the road, just at least to counter the fact that having Wout van Aert up the road, because you know Finestre is not a climb where even if you had teammates who were capable of riding at a high pace. It's not a fast climb because of the dirt. So you're not getting a super sit on the gravel anyway. So the best value you could have had in a teammate was the way that Jumbo played it, and that have someone in front that can wait. So that's the first thing. And then the second thing, obviously, is the cat and mouse games we saw between Del Toro and Carapaz on the Finestre, which is a real hard one to explain, a really hard one to explain.
Well, have a go. I mean, what do you think was happening? Because obviously it was complicated for Del Toro because, yes, Simon Yates was going away, but he did have 1 minute 21 to play with there. So it wasn't really starting to get dangerous until it was 30, 40 seconds. You could argue it's too late by then anyway. But Carapaz was a much more lively threat. Would Del Toro have been fearing, especially if he was isolated by that stage, he had no teammates with him? That was the crucial thing, wasn't it? If he'd had a McNulty or a Micah to ride on the front, Carapaz wouldn't have been able to lure him into this track stand type slowing down, speeding up. So that was critical, I guess. But Del Toro must have been fearful that if he rode, again, knowing his legs, knowing his body, if he rode and overextended it, he would be vulnerable to the counterattack from Carapaz. So, you know, what mistakes did he make and what could he perhaps have done differently? Bearing in mind, it's still 40 minutes to go to the top. It's a long way.
Yeah. Well, I said the one way to counteract that is have someone satellite rider waiting for him at the top. Then the other part was, look, Anna Carapaz was very, very aggressive even earlier in the day on the early climbs. But I think when you get to a certain point and the time's starting to go out, I think just riding at a steady tempo would have been the smartest thing to do for both those guys. Because like I said before, how much of a sit are you really getting on the Finestre going 15K an hour on gravel? You know, and if he was, I know his mindset was probably, I don't want to keep getting hit from behind from Carapaz. But at the end of the day, after a couple of times, Carapaz on the wheel at whatever kilometers per hour, he's not getting that big of a sit. Yes, he would have thrown the kitchen sink at him, but he did anyway. And he showed that he had the legs to match it. So, look, I dare say he was under instructions from the car, but at some point when Simon starts riding away, then that tactic has to change. Obviously, the tactic was to follow Carapaz, But when third place goes up the road, yeah, you've got to adapt. You've got to adapt. And riding at a pace where Simon's not taking big chunks of time, knowing that, oh, okay, I've got no one in front to help me here, and knowing that they have Walt van Aert, one of the best bike riders in the world, waiting, that's when the alarm bell should have really started ringing, because that was a concoction that ended in disaster.
Do you think there was a moment where he was maybe hoping somebody from behind was going to come up? I mean, we didn't really see anything from behind, and it wasn't until much later when we see the results that we get an idea of where the likes of Micah or McNulty or Yates might have been. But, you know, he's probably trying to process quite a lot of information there. And as you say, young rider, never been in this position before, but it does boil down to you've got the pink jersey on your back. Just ride steady, fast, steady, and just don't get suckered into freewheeling, because every 5 meters of freewheeling was giving Simon Yates another 5-6 seconds, wasn't it?
Yeah, it was crazy. And you saw that actually they were going that slow that when Derek G did come from behind, you know, Derek G was just riding his pace on the Finestra, but you saw that that just wasn't fast enough, because any time that, Carapaz or attacked, they would see you later. They would just ride it off into the distance. So that was a problem. And look, the team knows where McNulty is. They know where Maker are. They know how far back they are, because it's actually quite hard for the team cars to get up to the riders on that climb, because they do barrage them back a lot. So they would have had a fair idea. And yeah, you know, I dare say the numbers, the coaches and the sports directors know what's possible. And at one stage, because if it was 30 seconds at the top, then I'm sure Carapaz would have chimed in. I dare say Carapaz at some stage would have said, well, I will work with you here until we catch the eights, because I'd rather finish second than third. So there was a little bit of a Mexican standoff, pardon the pun. But yeah, at the end of the day, when at a certain point, tactics needed to change from both those guys.
When did you know it was done and that Yates was going to win?
I think the biggest, over the top looked good, but I think even the commentators, no one knew where Walt was. So when Walt came into the shot there, you know, on a flat section of the descent, I was like, well, that's it. That is all over now. Because, and to see that Walt still had legs. He still had legs. Now, he might have been dead in the water. He might not have been able to contribute too much to Simon, you know. But as soon as you saw Simon get to him, sit on the wheel there, it was like, well, this is not coming back now. Because, you know, they weren't coming back from behind. There was going to be no extra help to help Carapaz or Del Toro from behind. And the gap was enough there that, you know, now Simon's getting a 15-minute sit here, time to refuel, to drink, to get some gels in, relax, knowing that I'm going out here and that the two climbers behind are not going to be taking any time back on Walt van Aert giving 110%. So that was the icing. That was definitely the icing on the cake. As soon as Walt came into the picture and Simon was on the wheel there, that was like, that's all she wrote. She's all she wrote.
Relax, relax. I mean, it's all relative, Matt, isn't it? It must have been relaxing for him there, sat on the wheel. But the other thing was, you know, Simon Yates riding for the Giro win, a totally different sort of mental job as well. I mean, that road up to Sestriere, it's not a climber's road really, is it? It's a sort of hybrid climber's Wout van Aert road, isn't it? But paradoxically, horrible to have to chase on. But, you know, mentally, if you know you're putting people under pressure, I mean, the gap was going out because Simon Yates was completely unencumbered. He didn't have people, you know, sitting on his wheel, you know, he was able to just pour everything into it, knowing that those kilometers were ticking down.
Yeah, and you saw the legs that Simon had when they came through and they mopped up a few other guys from the breakaway, and they were sitting on Simon, and as soon as Walt peeled over, Simon just chucked it into third gear and off he went, and the guys, no one could do anything about it either, and it was just enough recovery. And Simon, obviously full of confidence and very, very, you know, very close to winning the Giro at that stage. You know, he put the nail in the coffin there. But you know, the damage was done with the major damage was done with the two things: the stop starting of on the Finestra between the two leaders, or the first and second, and then obviously having one of the world's best bike riders waiting for you over the other side.
Yeah, I mean, just talk about that a little bit, because it's very easy for us, me as an armchair sports director and you as a very experienced sports director, but on this occasion sitting in the armchair, it's very easy to look at it and go, wow, Visma Elisabike, they played a blinder there, they did this, they did this, they did this, and it all worked out. But all of the things that had to go in their favour, such as UAE or EF not getting a rider in that break, for one thing, so Wout van Aert was kind of free to do a thing, but he still had to hope that the gap would go up enough that they would have a chance. He had to hope that he'd be able to climb well enough to get over the Finestre without Simon Yates catching. Because if Simon Yates had caught him, I don't know, K and a half from the top, he would have been, well, he would have been useless to Yates. So it had to work out to an absolute T, didn't it?
It did. And there's a lot of those factors that you just explained were totally out of their control. Because at the end of the day, if someone like the days prior, Bora, for example, had missed the break and they wanted to chase the win with somebody else and rode tempo, and they'd started the Finestre with 4 minutes instead of 9 minutes, well, then it would have made Wout van Aert totally irrelevant. So that they had a plan, they executed the plan, and then things did fall into place for them. Because at the end of the day, UAE or EF also could have changed the dynamic. They could have put guys on the front into the Finestre and shaved that gap down enough that Wout van Aert became irrelevant. So it was, you know, the race wasn't over. Okay, you can make mistakes, but you can rectify them as well. And I think that was a big one, letting him play a big part in the last 30 to 40 minutes, having Wout there and having Simon. That's just enough time to recover as well.
How did you kind of feel for Simon Yates on a personal level? I mean, have you spoken to him at all? Or are you just letting him enjoy his moment? Because you've shared some real highs and lows in Grand Tours before, and you know him very well. You know what makes him tick.
Yeah, no, we've exchanged some messages. No, I'm incredibly happy for him. Incredibly happy for him because, you know, he spent his whole career with us until this year. So his whole 9 or 10 years. So, And you know, he's not going to get the same opportunities at Visma because of the likes. He's got one of the world's best stage race riders in his own team. But Simon knew what he'd signed up for. And when I saw that he was getting an opportunity at the Giro, and he was just chipping away in the spring. He wasn't anything special in this, before the Giro this year. But sometimes, especially in a race like the Giro, that's also a great way to attack it. You know, so Simon wasn't in really super form until the Giro. Whereas, you know, it's always tricky managing peaks in a season. And now he's got 4 weeks to recover for the Tour de France, where he's going to play an incredibly important role for Vingegaard. But, I'm really, really happy for him. And, yeah, it's the last time he won a stage race was the Vuelta back 7 years ago. But he's been a very, very consistent performer in those 9 years. And, not too many riders can finish their career having won two Grand Tours as well. He's definitely one of the legends of this era of cycling.
And what about Isaac Del Toro? Because although he's a lot younger than Simon Yates was in 2018, he'll feel the same sense of disappointment, the fact that it was so close. I would say that the people around him would be confident enough to say to him, your chance will come again and learn from this. But he doesn't know that at the moment, does he? He doesn't know whether a Grand Tour will be 48 hours away from, you know, being within his grasp.
No. It'll be a hard period for him for sure. But there's a hell of a lot of confidence that any 21-year-old can take away from the rides that he's done. And look, he's got a lot of room for improvement. This kid is going to be a major player in the world of professional cycling for the next decade. So he will have his opportunities. When and where? Who's to know? Who knows? But no, Grand Tours. You know, finishing a Grand Tour is an achievement. Arriving on a podium in a Grand Tour is a big achievement. And then not until you finally win one, you realise that things have got to go right for 21 days to get the job done. So, he'll take a lot of confidence out of it. And look, UAE have got another very, very special athlete on their hands.
And what about your old team, Jayco Alula? How did you assess the couple of stage wins they had? I mean, Luke Platt's stage win was at that point in the race, it was one of the most kind of dynamic stage victories we'd seen so far. You know, I think the first breakaway to have made it. I need to double check that. But then Chris Harper, tried, try, and try again. I think he was in two breaks before Saturday, wasn't he, over the final week. And I mean, it's unfortunately for him, he won't forget it, but pretty much the Italian TV director was focused so much on the Yates versus Carapaz and Del Toro battle that we really only saw Chris Harper come up over the top of the Finestra, and then we saw him at the finish line. But what did you make of those two stage wins and generally the Jayco Alula Giro?
Yeah, so look, at the start of the year, the plan was for both Luke Plapp and Chris Harper to ride general classification at the Giro. And then, Plappy had a scaphoid issue, which needed surgery in February. So that put him really behind the eight ball with his preparation for the Giro. So we spoke to him and his coach prior to the race, and we had, like, listen, I know this part of your development to ride GC here, but it's not realistic to attempt 3 weeks with the work that you've done. And so we spoke to him about changing his tact and go after stages, which obviously worked really well. And then with Chris, he's had some issues with his leg for 5 or 6 months now, which are not completely resolved. And the issue there is he just struggles a little bit when he's going above threshold. So like I said, he's ridden the Giro not with an injury, but with an injury. You know, he's not able to be his best at the Giro. We saw that with how he faded in the second week there, but that's due to an injury, which hopefully he can get on top of. But you know, he's such a diesel, and the stage really worked in his favour on Saturday, because it was a stage there where he won the stage by being the best in the breakaway and by going long and just out-grinding his opponents there. And like, even he didn't really attack Vieri on Finestra. Just gradually grinded him off the wheel. And, you know, like he needed things to play into his situation well. You know, like I said, if a team had jumped on the front and that breakaway had hit the bottom of the Finestra with 4 minutes instead of 8 or 9, the break wouldn't have stayed away either. But that's cycling. You've got to roll the dice and be prepared to lose. And he gave himself every opportunity to win the stage. So very, very happy for Chris. His first big win as a professional. And on such an iconic day of the Giro, where actually a friend of his who won the race. So yeah, there were some great scenes after the race. Those two guys embracing each other, and they're good mates, and they train a bit together in Andorra, and been teammates for a couple of years. So, and it was great to see both those guys pull off the biggest wins of their career on the same day.
And how did you find watching it at home? Frustrating, I imagine, not to be there. Did you miss being there?
Different. It's the first time in more than 20 years that I have spent the month of May at home and not in a team car at a race that I really, really do love. Oh, you certainly get to see the race a lot more on television in a different way, that's for sure. But I've been spending some nice time with the family and getting out on the bike myself, and then coming home in the afternoon and flicking on the television and watching the race unfold in a different way than I'm used to over the last two decades.
But what's next for you, Matt? I'm imagining that you want to get back in somewhere or another. Have you had any conversations? Have you got a time frame for when you want to try and get yourself another role?
Yeah, look, I've had some conversation already with a couple of organisations, and I'll definitely be back in what role, we'll see. I think for me, I really want to be part of an organisation where I can have an impact. I've put 14 years of my life into this team, from creating the team back in 2011 to starting it in 2012. And, you know, the last couple of years, I've moved away from being just a sports director there, and I had involvement in really helping progress the women's team, and then working with the development team. And so I've done some different roles over the last couple of years, but I love being, you know, rolling the sleeves up and getting and putting plans together and getting involved with the athletes and seeing people get the best out of themselves. So, yeah, it'll be interesting. Watch this space. But I'll definitely be back. But in what role, we'll see.
What about the Tour de France? Will you be still watching at home on TV this July, or might something come up before then?
I'm actually doing some television, actually, for the last week of the tour. Yeah, I'm going to do the last week be commentating in pre- and post-race shows. And there's some other offers as well. So I will be busy in July. which will be again very strange not being in the team car. But no, it's good. I said I haven't spent summer actually at home with my family for, well, my kids, my oldest son's 15. So he just knows, all my kids know me being away for the month of May, the month of July, which has been the same since they've been born. So to have me at home, we'll see how things go. They're not used to having their dad at home for summer. But like I said, I won't be at home for all of summer either. I've got some things to do with television and looking forward to at the Tour de France from a different angle like I did this year in the Giro.
Well, we look forward to seeing you back out there at the races. But in the meantime, the TV viewers will get the benefit of your insight, Matt. And I certainly appreciate you helping me to sort of unpick what actually we witnessed on Saturday at the Giro. So thanks very much for joining me.
No, pleasure, mate. A pleasure.
Well, I hope you enjoyed that conversation with Matt White there, and especially his tactical insight into what was going on the Finestre on Saturday, and also his memories of 2018, which in a lot of ways foreshadowed what happened at the end of this year's Giro. Now, perhaps understandably, Matt was pretty tight-lipped there about the circumstances that led to his departure from the Jayco Alula team on the eve of the Giro. He didn't want to go into details, and I didn't feel there was a lot to be gained from hammering away, asking the same question with different wording. You don't need to be a genius to work out that it was out of the blue for him. He didn't want to leave, and he also will want to find his way back into the World Tour with another team as soon as a suitable opportunity presents itself. Daniel and I did see Brent Copeland at the airport in Tirana when we arrived in Albania for the start of the Giro, and he wasn't giving too much away either. But over the next few days, we did hear a few rumours that the reason given for Matt White's sudden departure was results-based after a disappointing spring across both the men's and the women's teams. Now, dealing with the men's team and the Spring Classic campaign and looking at the roster, Michael Matthews was 4th at Milan-San Remo, 5th at Amstel Gold, 10th at Flèche Wallonne and 11th at Liège-Bastogne-Liège. Okay, no podium performance, but given the lineup of riders and kind of the lack of real classics support riders and riders capable of getting results in classics, that wasn't a disastrous spring campaign, really. So what is clear is that there has been quite a lot of change behind the scenes at Jayco Alula over the past 18 months, a lot of staff coming and going, and I gather there might be similar changes over the winter with the rider roster. We'll have to wait and see. But clearly, Jayco Alula are going in a different direction and someone will benefit from Matt White's experience in the future. That's all for this week's episode of the Cycling Podcast. We'll be back next week. And in the meantime, have a look at the 1101 Cappuccino, our newsletter, which is distributed on Substack. I've written a couple of things this week. The first is really getting into the weeds of Saturday's 20th stage on the Giro, how the Giro was won and lost on the Finestre. You can sign up for the 1101 Cappuccino for free at thecyclingpodcast.com or check it out on Substack and read some of our other posts. There'll be something else going live later on this week, and if you subscribe, you'll get that directly in your inbox. So until next week, thank you very much for listening. This episode was produced by Tom Wally.
The Cycling Podcast was created in 2013 by Richard Moore, Daniel Freeb, and Lionel Burney.